Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How can some people use drugs and alcohol without getting hooked while others spiral into life-threatening abuse and addiction? David Sheff's journey to understanding the nature of addiction began when his then-teenage son Nick developed a serious problem, which he wrote about in his best-selling memoir, Beautiful Boy. His new book looks at progress in scientific understanding of the mechanisms of addiction, compares the effectiveness of various treatment approaches, and aims to dispel a number of persistent myths about addicts and their illness. The book is called Clean: Overcoming Addiction and Ending America's Greatest Tragedy. David Sheff is in town to speak tonight at Highland Park High School. The event starts at 6:30, and it is open to the public. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's great to be here.
You remind us that addiction is a family disease. There's never just one person affected.
Well, absolutely true. And I learned the hard way. My son, you know, just like so many of us, you know, he's growing up, I worried about drugs. And then, you know, caught him smoking pot when he was 12. And I sort of, you know, did what parents do. Oh, you know, it's kind of normal. Kids, you know, it's a rite of passage, they experiment. But then when this became a serious drug problem, I was devastated. My family was devastated. We barely survived it. You know, couples break up over this and families explode because we are so worried about the person we love. It's so baffling. You know, if your child or, you know, if your child had a disease, another disease, you know what to do. You know, you would get sympathy and from people around you. You would talk about it and you would get them, you would take them to a doctor. With this one, oftentimes we keep it hidden. There's a shame around it, and we don't even know what to do, where to start.
Did you worry that people would judge you because your son had a drug problem?
I did. I thought, what would people think of me that my son, you know, became an addict? I mean, we don't know addicts, at least I didn't, and I had this image of what an addict was, you know, sort of when you walk down the street, the kind of person that you might see in a doorway, you know, psychotic, passed out, whatever. And I also worried what people would think of him because I wanted to protect his you know, people's impressions of him. And he was a sweet, sweet, lovely boy. And you know, the typical thing we always hear, he was a good student. He was an athlete. And yet this had happened to him. And so at first I was so bewildered by it and ashamed and afraid that so I kept it a deep, dark art secret in our family for a long time. Even close friends didn't know. And it's common. I hear from people all the time that they hide because of shame.
What do we know now about the breakdown between genetic proclivity toward addiction, between early exposure, between comorbid mental illness in creating addiction?
But what we know now is that, first of all, there was this traditional idea that addicts were, you know, somehow immoral. They were weak. They brought this upon themselves. And if they were a good person, they would just stop. But now we know that addiction is a brain disease. And, you know, as you suggest, it happens to people because of a number of reasons. Some of it isn't known. But what we do know is that the earlier a person starts using, the more likely it will become addiction. People with genetic predispositions, meaning addiction, alcoholism in a family, makes it more likely. People who have mental illnesses, you know, the kids who are growing up with depression or intense anxiety or other problems, when they finally use drugs, many of them describe it as medicine. They start to feel better. People who suffer traumas are more likely to become addicted, you know, a really contentious, bad divorce, the loss of someone in their life. You know, violence, of course, and then people who live in certain neighborhoods. You know, poverty is a predictor. All kinds. You know, people who live sometimes in neighborhoods where there's so much violence and there's so much stress. On one hand, and then you also have this research that shows that the kind of stress that maybe has to do with just modern times in certain other communities, which is about, you know, kids who are. It's all about AP classes and ballet classes and soccer and just being as busy, you know, trying to fill out your college resume when you're 12. I mean, that is common, and all of those things, especially when you combine them, it's a recipe for addiction.
I want to talk about this factor of starting early and early exposure. I think in the book you say 90% of addicts have started by the time they're teenagers.
That's
using
right.
Some substance. Is there something about the nature of a developing brain that makes it more susceptible.
There is, which is why it's so dangerous. I mean, the exact time when most of our kids, if they're going to try drugs, try them, it's the most dangerous time for them because their brains are developing more than they ever will in their lives, except for when they're, you know, under 2 years old. And the teenage brain, you know, it doesn't all develop at the same time. The part that is developing first is the – I mean, we always think of teenagers as sort of crazy and impulsive, and it's because there's a biological piece of that. It's because the part of their brain, the rear part of the brain that is related to pleasure-seeking and impulsivity is what develops first. And the part of the brain that normally would restrain that would sort of bring in the moderation and rationality. It's like, you know, we have to – no, I can't, you know, jump off a bridge because I might hurt myself. I can't use drugs.
The boring old prefrontal cortex.
Exactly.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And that hasn't developed yet. And when you take drugs, it actually makes that worse. In other words, it takes longer for the prefrontal cortex to develop. So that means that those restraints are going to it's going to happen over time less and less, which means there's more likelihood that that impulsivity and that pleasure seeking stuff is going to be driving, which means more drug use, and then that, you know, further impedes the development, and then that cycle continues, which is it's a disaster for many people, and it leads to addiction. And it also leads, in some cases, you know, a person doesn't have to become addicted to have, you know, these catastrophic consequences because of drug use. I mean, people overdose and die because of, you know, they've tried drugs once or twice or three times, or else they get behind the wheel, of course, and we all know that that can lead to death.
We will talk about the more hopeful stuff later in the hour, but I do want to let people know who might be thinking, I got to turn the radio off because I can't take this. Another point that you're really adamant about here is that hope is certainly justified. It is possible to get effective treatment, and it is possible to achieve not only a state of being drug-free, but mental health.
It is, and people need to know that because the problem is so great that it's easy to feel defeated. I mean, we know that 350 people die a day in America. You know, this illness around the disease, I mean, addiction not only causes overdoses, but it causes, it causes heart attacks, strokes, liver problems, and also the societal costs. I mean, the reason our prisons are overcrowded is because of drugs and addiction, and the reason our hospitals are overcrowded and drowning and at a time when our hospital, I mean, when healthcare is just such a dire problem. We have addicts, people who have addiction going in and going in and going in to treatment over and over and over again. And instead of treating the problem, they're patched up and sent out, and then they return. So it seems like such a big, overwhelming problem. But there is more and more evidence that this is a problem that is both preventable and treatable. The crime is that we're not preventing it or treating it well. But the hopeful news is that once we get educated and we rely on the research that has shown, you know, what works, what doesn't work, and that happens more and more. And not only do we have that research, that understanding, but it also has to be available to people who need it. And that's happening too, but it's happening very slowly.
All right, let's talk about prevention efforts. You know, I have four kids, and for years they've come home. They came home from elementary school, and everybody wears red socks tomorrow because it's anti-drug day, and there's a DARE program. We have DARE, we have Just Say No campaigns, and yet they are not evidence-based programs, and in fact, the evidence that has the research that has been done shows that they don't work.
It's so discouraging. We don't want our kids using drugs. Schools take this on as a challenge, and many of the schools feel defeated. I've heard from principals and counselors that they try everything to stop their kids from using, and in fact, drug use doesn't go down; it actually goes up. And part of the reason that it's failing is because we're doing it wrong. We know that telling kids just say no doesn't work. We know that the DARE campaign, which is really what is used in more schools in America, because it's what people assume is going to work because it's just been around. And we know that it not only doesn't lower drug use, but it actually increases drug use. What we're starting to understand now is that if we approach it in a very, very different way, then we actually can have an impact and lower drug use and lower the chances that somebody will become addicted. There's a lot of evidence that, first of all, education does work. If we target it, if we talk to kids with respect, if we don't talk down to them, if we don't give them these sort of scare tactics that they kind of roll their eyes and dismiss, if we give them information about specific drugs, about, you know, why do we feel high? Why does it feel good to get high? Well, if people understand what's going on in the brain and they understand the interaction, why drugs make that happen, then they also will be open when they start to hear about the destructive piece of it, when it starts to cause brain damage, which it does. The other thing that is proven to be effective is that once we know that these risk factors, like we talked about, you know, before, somebody with depression, somebody who's just dealing with a life crisis, whatever it is, we know that those can lead to drug use. Then we start understanding that if we can intervene in those problems early, we're going to make it so much less likely that a person will try drugs in the first place, and then if they'll have drug problems. So that means training teachers, and even pediatricians don't know about this because they haven't been trained. How do you recognize a person that has a potential drug problem? You know, what's the difference when a parent is looking at their child and they see some depression, or they see this kind of, they're kind of real, seem to be really anxious? I mean, we don't know. We're parents, you know, so we think, well, it's part of growing up. People are stressed out. It's hard. But once we realize that, as a doctor said to me, if you think there's a problem, there's a problem. If you think something's wrong, something's wrong. If you suspect something's wrong, the advice of all the experts is don't rely on your own judgment, because we're not trained. You know, we just are trained. We love them. We want to take care of them. But we have to go seek professional advice. So go see a doctor. Go see somebody who knows about addiction. If it seems like your child is suffering from whatever it is, I mean, if they seem overly depressed, if they seem really isolated, if they – whatever it is, find the appropriate person to at least find out if there's a problem. Maybe there isn't. But if there is, you want to get on it the second you can.
You know, the irony, David, is I think what stops some parents from seeking help is the maybe there isn't factor. People think, well, if my suspicions are not actually based on reality, then I'm going to lose the trust of my child.
I think that our kids want to be protected, even though teenagers are probably not going to tell us that. It's more important to have those conversations, even if it's uncomfortable. And I think part of the problem that we have as parents these days, I had it, I know I'm not, I know it really well, is that we kind of want our kids to like us, and we want to be their friends, and we want to be have these sort of relationships. I certainly never had that kind of relationship with my parents. They were sort of a force, and it wasn't necessarily all this open communication. And the open communication part is really good, but also our kids need us. They need clear direction. They need guidelines. They need us to model the kinds of behavior. I mean, one of the ways that we can protect our kids right away is if there's a drug problem in the house or somebody has a problem with alcohol, the risks of a child using and having problems is so much higher. So the first thing we all need to know is that if that's going on, that needs to be addressed. There are conversations with our kids. If we're honest with them, if there are consequences for their actions, if we're modeling good behavior, if they know how we feel. A lot of parents these days, I hear it over and over again. Some parents will tell me, I smoked when I was a kid. You know, it's not that big a deal. I want my kids to learn how to use drugs in moderation, so that, you know, it's okay if they have a glass of wine or if they smoke a joint now and then, because otherwise when they go off to college, they're just going to go raving and binge drinking. Well, all the evidence says that that's completely wrong thinking. If you are setting your values matter, and if you are setting up a structure in the home that says that drug use is okay, then that is what kids learn. And this idea that if kids learn early, they will use less drugs is wrong. The earlier kids start using drugs, the more likely they're going to have drug problems.
David Sheff is with us. His new book is called Clean: Overcoming Addiction and Ending America's Greatest Tragedy. He's in town to speak tonight at 6:30 at Highland Park High School. That event is open to the public. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist and author David Sheff. His new book is called Clean, Overcoming Addiction and Ending America's Greatest Tragedy. He'll be speaking at the Dallas Country Club tomorrow at 11:30 to benefit CARE. There'll be a link to that on the Think page. He's also got an appearance tonight at 6:30 at Highland Park High School. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So when we look at drug addiction as an illness, illnesses, we understand, need treatment. But some treatments work and some treatments don't. And yet we still, it sounds like, have a wide variety of options out there. And it can be tough for families to know where to turn.
When my son needed help, it was a crisis. I mean, I was in denial, I think, for a long time until he was almost dead. I mean, when I heard from him. I hadn't known where he was for 3 or 4 days, and I went and found him, and it was clear to me that we needed to get him help. And that's when I realized what a nightmare the addiction treatment system is in this country, because there was nowhere to go. And I made 100 phone calls, and I heard all kinds of things. Some people told me to kick him out. Some people told me to send him to boot camp. Some people told me to send him to some wilderness program. And I just didn't know. And finally, I sent him to a program, and It was just random. I mean, we know what to do. If somebody we love if a child, God forbid, has some disease, we go to the doctor. And the doctor will probably do tests, and those tests will determine what's going on. And then the doctor may suggest a specialist. There will be a few treatment options. With this problem, people get into a system where it's just a catastrophe. There's no rhyme or reason. Many of the people who treat addiction in programs and rehabs are incredibly well-meaning people, but they have no credentials whatsoever. Their only credential is that something worked for them. They're in recovery, which is great, but it doesn't necessarily mean that's going to help anybody else. A lot of the programs, about 90% of the programs are in America, don't take into consideration the fact that many people who become addicted have other problems, some co-occurring disorders, psychological disorders. And that is, it has to be, those have to be recognized and treated if somebody's going to be able to get sober and stay sober, because it's a cycle. If somebody's using medication, using drugs as to self-medicate, then as soon as they get off drugs, whatever it was, their depression, their bipolar disorder is going to kick in again, and unless that's treated as well. So we need programs that offer a range of treatments that take into account all the reasons people use. And it's really complicated, and no two people are alike. So instead of a treatment program that basically treats everyone the same, as if an addict is an addict is an addict and they all have to do the same thing, we need a program that involves an addict going into treatment and a thorough assessment is done, a physical exam, consultations between a psychiatrist, psychologist. What's going on? Once they know what's going on, they can decide, you know, is there a problem? Maybe there's no problem. If there is a problem, is it mild? Is there some brief intervention that would work? Or does somebody need more serious treatment? And what treatment is that?
This is really important for parents, and it's something that I wouldn't have thought of before reading your book. If you have a child who is a teenager, go get help the first time before they're 18, because you can actually compel your minor child to go to rehab. But once that child is 18 in one day, they're, in the eyes of the law, adults.
Yeah, in the eyes of the law, adults. I mean, we all know that 18-year-olds aren't necessarily adults. But it's still possible to get a person into treatment when they're 18. I mean, my son went into treatment once before he was 18, and I did get to say, you are going, and there was no options here. And then he did turn 18, and the difference was, rather than if I went into a program, I could have signed him in before he was 18. He had to sign himself in. We do still have leverage. I mean, we have relationships with our kids. We have a lot of influence on them, and you know, there are other ways that they rely on us, and we just have to, no matter how old they are, we have to do everything we can to get them into treatment. But if a child is having problems when they're a teenager, there's so many reasons that that's the time to intervene. Part of it is that it's easier to get them into treatment. You do have more control. But the other part is that the longer this is ignored, the worse it's going to get, and it becomes harder to treat.
How did you cope as a parent with the frustrating emotions that you had to deal with? Because if, God forbid, a child has a very serious physiological illness, it doesn't necessarily deeply affect their behavior. You're less likely to be sort of disappointed in the turn of events. Can you talk a little bit about working through that process?
Well, when Nick, my son, became addicted, I was shocked and horrified, because this person that I knew was this lovely person who was moral, who cared about people, was doing things that were just terrifying and unconscionable. I mean, he was breaking into our house. I had to change the locks so that my own son, wasn't coming into our house to steal my checks and credit cards and even money from his little brother, who he loved. I mean, it made no sense whatsoever. You know, he ended up doing just one thing after the other. He broke into our friends' houses. He was arrested. I mean, these were things that I could not ever have imagined. I didn't sleep. I was a wreck. My wife and I would stay up all night when he wouldn't come home. You know, the phone would ring in the middle of the night. My heart would stop. Parents who've been through this know. And a sheriff called to tell me that he'd been arrested. Another time, an emergency room doctor called to tell me that he was going to die possibly and I should get down right away. And so I only survived this, I think, first of all, I had the support of my family. Secondly, my wife and I saw counselors, a family therapist, and at least we were able to process some of what we were going through, get information, what was going on, you know, understand a little bit more what it means to be a drug addict, what it means to have a child as a drug addict. We went to Al-Anon meetings, which is a 12-step group for families that are suffering, that have someone in their family who's suffering from addiction. And all these things helped. I mean, they certainly didn't solve the problems. There was no such thing as any, there was no panacea. It was really intensely hard, and it went on for year after year after year. But I wouldn't have survived it without that extra support.
The old advice said, if you love someone who is an addict, you have to wait for them to hit bottom before they are ready to consider any kind of therapy. You say, don't wait.
Don't wait. This idea that people have to hit bottom it's an old idea that is really, really dangerous and destructive. I just heard just last week from a parent who told me that his child was in a couple rehabs in a row, and he left and he relapsed, and he was on the streets as he had been earlier. And he was told by the addiction counselors that, you know, he should just stand back and let his son hit bottom. That was the only thing that was going to work. His son had to get so desperate that he would do anything to get well. And his son overdosed and died. He said, you know, has he hit bottom now? It's too dangerous. We have to do everything we can. And we have to do everything we can to get a person in treatment. The second the second it's needed, because it gets harder to get them into treatment the worse their problem gets and the worse damage is caused. I mean, these are toxic drugs, and the more they use, I mean, if you can get someone to treatment, people think, you know, sometimes, you know, the first time I got Nick into treatment, it was a 28-day program, and I thought, thank God, this is over. I'll pick him up in 28 days, and he's going to be
fixed.
Fine.
Right.
He'll be fixed. He'll go off to college. Everything's going to be great in our family. That's not necessarily the way it works, but still, getting him off the streets, even if the treatment wasn't ideal, it may have saved his life because he was in such bad shape. If he had gone out and scored drugs that day or that night or the next day, who knows?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone with Kim in Richardson. Hi, Kim.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to ask your guest, and you touched on this a moment ago, but what do you do when they're 19 and they refuse to go for help? And this is marijuana only. There's nothing else going on. He works. He goes to school. He seems like he's in control of everything, but, you know, it's not something that we approve of. What do I do?
Well, you know, in this world, again, people talk about tough love, and I don't believe in tough love. I believe in love, and I think that it's really hard. He's 19. Kids always feel like they know more than their parents. People think, you know, well, I'm just smoking pot. It's not that big of a deal. If you're concerned, you know, as this other doctor told me, if you're concerned, there's probably reason to be concerned. And so you just have to do everything you can. And part of it is persistent but loving conversations, but expressing your concern. And if you can see somebody, which is what I would recommend the first thing is to find somebody, a psychiatrist or the psychologist, who knows about working with kids and families who are dealing with addiction, who are dealing with drug problems. And first of all, tell them about your son and talk about the problem. And also, maybe that person can help you get your son to, even if they're not going to say, I'm going to go into treatment, even if they don't say, I'm addicted, maybe you can get them to, you could say, at least go see this person. And that may begin the process. And it's a hard process and it can take time, but don't give up.
David, what's the difference between experimenting with drugs and alcohol and using drugs and alcohol?
It's a really fine distinction. It's a slippery slope, and there's not a real strong definition. I mean, one of the doctors I spoke to said, experimenting is you try something a couple times, more than that is using. And the whole idea of this sort of this gradation of using, it's so confusing because then people want to know, well, when does using become abuse? And then when does abuse become addiction? And what the problem is that there isn't a fine line and that it's easy for one to lead to the next, to lead to the next, to lead to the next. So the distinctions almost don't matter. What it matters is that since we realize that progression is possible, we want to do what we can to stop it wherever it is. If a child is experimenting, you know, people always say that, you know, this whole idea of that marijuana, for instance, is a gateway drug is wrong and it's scare tactics and it's reefer madness. And of course, marijuana isn't always a gateway drug. But when someone starts to use pot or start to drink, they're going to be more likely to try other drugs. So it's not enough. I think it's dangerous for parents just to assume, well, that's the way it is. And you know, it's okay.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Duke in Aubrey. Hi, Duke.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well,
thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I had a question for your guest about concerning medical cannabis. I'm a veteran, and I use cannabis to deal with PTSD. And also, I'm a former addict myself, and I've never really had any problems going back to using any other kinds of narcotics. I just keep smoking cannabis.
Well, this is what I'd say, Duke, about it. First of all, if what you just said about the last thing you just said, which is that you can smoke pot and you're an addict, and it doesn't cause you to relapse onto other drugs or to get in worse shape. If it works for you, then it works for you. But I guess the research shows that for many addicts, my son, Nick, was doing fine. He was in recovery, and he decided, well, I can just smoke some pot. It's not that big a deal. And he smoked pot, and pretty soon he was back on the streets with shooting heroin and crystal meth. Same thing. One time he said, well, I can't smoke pot, but I can just drink. The second part of what you were saying about medical marijuana is if it helps you, I mean, a lot of the doctors, a lot of the researchers disagree with this, but I feel that if it helps, great. My concern is that I don't want kids using, because I feel like kids, as we talked about before, kids' brains aren't developed enough. There's not a lot of ability in some kids for kids even to understand if they have a problem, if they don't have a problem. And that's why I really, because it's just so fraught, there's so many different things that can go wrong. I think that given what you're dealing with, I mean, you've been through, I don't have to tell you, you've been through hell. And if you have PTSD, you know, I mean, hopefully you've got other support as well. But if it helps, I say go for it.
What do we do, David, about this bright line that society draws, if scientists perhaps don't, between alcohol and all the other things that can get you high?
Well, right now, I think that all the people who study this will tell you that alcohol is just one of the other substances of abuse. We live in a culture where alcohol is just so prevalent, and it's hard for kids to understand that it is possible for people to have problems. Many times their parents will drink, and you know, what's wrong with the beer, and what's wrong with – and for many people, we all know that it's fine. I mean, that people do drink moderately. I can now go out to dinner with my son – and I can have a glass of wine or I can have a beer and I'm fine. I mean, I won't have another. Nick knows from experience that if he has a glass of wine or a beer, then the next thing he's going to be out is a liquor store and there's going to be a bottle of vodka and then he's going to be calling his drug dealer. So these are tricky drugs. I mean, when you talk about marijuana and alcohol, it's the trickiest of all. But they are also, they're common and they are also dangerous because, you know, alcohol actually leads to more deaths than marijuana by far. Leads to, not only to, first of all, people have alcohol poisoning, Also, it leads, of course, we all know that alcohol leads to traffic accidents, and it kills 180,000 people a year, and then other drugs kill about 40,000 people a year. So we're losing everyone. So this distinction that alcohol is safer than other drugs, it's just wrong.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Lisa in Carrollton. Hello, Lisa.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to, well, first of all, say thank you for having this subject today. My husband is a recovering addict. We've both been through a lot of education and treatment, and we're both in a 12-step program right now. And we're moving forward and thinking about having a family. And one of the discussions we've come up with is when we talk to kids about drug use, should we tell them about his history with drug use? And I was just wondering if your guest has, in his experience, if he feels like it's a good idea to kind of leave that out of that discussion. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
It's a really good question. And one of the best things that is happening is that you guys are talking about this, because so many parents, they don't. And I've talked to so many experts who study this stuff, and I've had some people say you should, some people say you shouldn't. What I think that the one piece of it that's the most important is that because we know that addiction is genetic and that it runs in families, that it would seem to me that at some point your child should know that he or she is more likely to have problems if they do try drugs or alcohol. And when that should happen, how you should talk about it. I think they always talk about what's appropriate for a child at a certain age. You don't want to give them too much information. You don't want to scare them at the same time. You want them to know. And, there's this ad campaign that has been around. They talk about, if you don't talk to your children about drugs, then who will? And you'd rather have them listen to it from you. And if you're honest with them, in my opinion, you have credibility.
My guest is journalist and author David Sheff. His new book is called Clean, Overcoming Addiction and Ending America's Greatest Tragedy. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author David Sheff. His new book is called Clean, Overcoming Addiction and Ending America's Greatest Tragedy. He'll be speaking tonight at Highland Park High School at 6:30 and tomorrow at the Dallas Country Club at 11:30 to benefit CARE. We'll have information about those appearances for you on the Think page. If you want to join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. We spend so much time lately, David, debating the question of whether we should criminalize drug-using behavior, drug possession. But it does occur to me that for now, while we have tens of thousands of people locked up in every state for drug crimes, it would seem like the perfect opportunity to provide some treatment for people. Are there ways that we can use periods of incarceration to do more than just get people detoxed?
Well, we should. In some places, there are more progressive policies. Drug courts will give people a choice between prison time or treatment. And places that don't offer that, it's bad policy for a lot of different reasons. Not only is it the right thing to do to try to help somebody get better if they have a health problem, but also if you don't treat somebody, then they're probably going to be back every time. It's going to be a cycle, and you're going to be spending money on the criminal justice piece of it. You're going to be filling up your prisons. And over and over and over again. Whereas once you have people in the system, what a great opportunity to sit somebody down, give them the counseling they need, give them the skills so that when they leave prison, they'll be able to stay clean. And that's sort of the hope, but that's the goal. But it's rarely, it happens very rarely around the country.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Josh in Richardson. Hi, Josh.
Hi. Really interesting program. I will try to be succinct. I was curious about two things. One is, earlier in the program, I believe that your guest said that, and I could be remembering wrong, but I believe he said that the younger that children are when they first start experimenting with, I guess, maybe alcohol or drugs, the more likely they are to end up being addicts. And I was just wondering, I can't cite a study, and I could be remembering this wrong also, but I thought there was a study maybe that was done in France where it showed that children there who were given small amounts of wine with meals were later on less likely to abuse alcohol because they had been exposed to it and taught how to use it reasonably. I hate to make the comparison, but kind of like if you have a gun in the house and you train your children, to not be near it or use it responsibly. The younger they are, the more likely they are to use them responsibly later. And then the other question is, I come from a family where virtually everybody else in my family is an addict as far as alcohol or drugs, and I've come to believe that I just did not get the gene because I do not have a problem with that at all. I'm wondering about if he would agree that there are a million little choices that parents make from the time their child is a toddler that eventually will add up to possibly their child, and I'm not blaming parents, but will eventually add up to their child maybe going one way or the other as far as using alcohol and drugs.
Well, you put a lot on the table there for us, Josh. Thank you very much for your call. Let's get some answers for you.
I don't know about the French study, and I've heard people say that, kids drink in Paris around the dinner table and their parents, put a little wine with their water. There may be other cultural differences that suggest that, that's really not applicable here. Because generally, not generally, there's studies, I've read them, that say that, kids who drink younger, nobody gets addicted. They say almost nobody gets addicted who waits until they're 18 to start using. And that includes drinking. So I'd love to hear more about what's going on in France and to see how it applies here. The other question is, I used to think, when Nick became addicted, I did what so many parents of people who become addicted do, and I blame myself when I look back on every single decision I made in the course of my life. And I know that I made a lot of mistakes. I had a very, very difficult divorce from Nick's mom, and I know that he suffered. And she moved she moved away from where I lived, and so he was doing this really terrible joint custody thing back and forth. And I knew, sometimes I felt maybe I was too lenient, sometimes I felt I was maybe too harsh. But overall, environment is a big, big piece of what causes addiction. But the biggest piece of all, from what the research says, is the genetic piece. It certainly doesn't mean if some families, I've met these people and, they have three or four kids and only one of them becomes addicted. And, there might be psychological issues going on that often there are psychological pieces to the addiction puzzle. And but sometimes it's, there are problems in families that are actually extreme that do contribute to addiction. I mean, dysfunctional families, lots of arguing and yelling around, these are kinds of things that do traumatize kids over a long period of time, really inconsistent parenting, or else parents who just aren't available to their kids. So people do, there are dynamics that do affect addiction. Whether or not, any one behavior, any one problem is going to lead to addiction, it's just not known. It's not knowable. And I think parents have so much on our shoulders. We do the best we can. We need support to do better. The more we're educated, parents who are dealing with a lot of stress, who are dealing with the loss, who are going through a divorce, it really helps to get yourself to get support, go to therapy, whatever it takes, family counseling, to help you understand how to navigate this and how to protect your children as much as we can.
We have an email here that asks, if there are consequences for drug use by an older sibling, does the percentage of future drug use in younger siblings go down? So in other words, I guess if a younger sibling sees that an older sibling has suffered for using drugs. Is the younger sibling somehow protected?
Well, we thought in our family that because I'd like to think, you know, my younger children saw their older brother. I mean, nobody has to tell them that drugs are dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, some kids just won't believe it. So I think that that's been, you know, if I suppose you could say that, you know, nothing good comes out of watching somebody you love in such terrible shape. But I think my younger kids really don't have to be told that drugs are dangerous. On the other hand, you do hear of examples where people would like that to be sort of, you know, we'd like our kids to learn from the parents and from their older siblings. But sometimes kids just mirror that behavior. Somehow if they see that an older child is, you know, that their big brother or their big sister is doing this stuff, even if there's some consequences, it might appear all of a sudden to be an option for them when it wasn't before. Or else maybe they may feel that there's something kind of cool about it, that it's part of being an adult or part of being more grown up or part of, you know, sort of emulating this person that they admire. So it's tricky, and I don't know if there's a real easy answer to that.
What do you recommend to people who want to get into treatment, want to get a loved one into treatment, and just don't have the money?
Well, there are fewer options. Just like with any health care, it's tough for people without insurance and who don't have access. One of the big, big problems in this country is related to the fact that people don't have enough health care in general, and mental health care is worse, and addiction care is even worse than that. But there are community organizations that do offer drug programs, and some of them are good. It just involves more work to find them. It involves more advocacy start with healthcare organizations, start with county organizations, state, city. You cannot give up. You just have to keep trying. And there are organizations like Salvation Army that has, in some places they have programs that are actually staffed by really good trained therapists. And they're sometimes, in some cases, better than programs that might cost someone $30,000 a month and the patients never even see a doctor. But it's hard. It's mm-hmm. absolutely hard in this country, and it's got to change.
I want to talk about relapse, because there are different approaches to dealing with this, too. There are some programs that say, when you get out of the program, if you relapse, you're on your own, buddy. And there are others that say, okay, come back and we'll work on this, and sort of look at relapse as a symptom of what is a chronic illness.
This is a chronic illness, which means it's like diabetes. It's something that if you've got it, you've got it. There is always the potential for relapse. The brain changes over the course of an addiction building. And that change, there's some evidence that brains eventually do heal. But most of the experts feel that there's always a vulnerability, so that people do relapse after 20 years, after 30 years. Some people go into treatment one time and they're fine. They stay clean the rest of their lives. Most often it doesn't happen that way. Relapse is not necessarily a sign that previous treatments have failed, because the doctors talk about something called a treatment trajectory, which means one time in treatment helps. It doesn't solve the problem, but it helps. Two times in treatment helps more. It helps a person understand what they are, who they are more. They understand their disease more. They understand how to stop a relapse from happening. Or if a relapse happens, it helps them control it, so it doesn't get into become a full-blown relapse. At the same time, every relapse is life-threatening, which is why we want to do everything we can to prevent relapses. A child that I met, this ties in both your questions, the one about insurance and this question of relapse. A mom I met got her daughter finally into treatment. She was 16 years old. She finally got her into a program. It was a touch and go to get her there because the daughter was in such bad shape. She breathed a sigh of relief. She thought her daughter was at least going to get the help she needed. She got a call after 6 days from the head of the program saying that she had to come back and she had to come pick up her daughter because the insurance was not going to pay for any more time there. She said, you know, what are you talking about? It was hell to get her in there. She cannot come home. And they said, I'm sorry, when the insurance is declined, there's nothing we can do. She went, she got her daughter. She brought her home and she got on the phone to try to figure out where she could take her daughter next. Her daughter snuck out, scored some drugs, and died that night.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Heather calling from Hearst. Hi, Heather.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Alcoholism runs in my family, and I have a 26-year-old who is an alcoholic, and she has a little sister who is 15.
And the 15-year-old knows who are the alcoholics are in my family and that they're in treatment. But we've also prepared her to handle it when people ask her or she's in a position to use drugs or alcohol. We've made it clear there are consequences. She will not have a car. She will... we've prepared her and rehearsed with her what she can say when people ask her so that she just won't have to say no, or she'll have some things automatically that she can think of that we've practiced that she can say to these people or her friends.
Is there evidence that sort of thing, it sounds like a reasonable strategy.
And it works. It sounds to me, Heather, that you're really doing the right thing. Not only are you educating your daughter, but you're also being aware of the reality, which is that if a child goes out on a Friday night to a party, hanging out with their friends, and someone hands them a joint, and if they don't have sort of an arsenal of strategies in reserve, then they have two choices, either to say no, which is hard to expect for a lot of kids in that social peer pressure sort of situation, or to smoke, to accept the beer, whatever it is. And so what you're doing is you're giving your child more options. They will have things to say, and it will, because they've rehearsed them, it's more likely that they're going to be able to draw on those.
Are there particular sort of magic options you can give kids? I've heard people saying, tell their kids, you can tell your friends that I drug test you once a month, and therefore you can't drink this, you can't smoke this, you can't whatever.
That works in some cases for sure. One thing that they suggest that we do is we have a sort of a system set up with our kids that if they feel in any way unsafe, if they feel that they're in a situation where they're either going to have to make a choice that they don't want to have to make to use drugs or not to use drugs, but also to put them in some sort of socially awkward situation, to send us a quiet text that is a message to us that we know that we have to then call them up on their phone. They answer their phone in front of their kids. They can then hang up the phone and say, oh, God, my parents are coming to get me because, you know, whatever they've got, my parents are, they can use whatever words they want to describe you, but, you know, because I have to get up in the morning and we're going to go see my grandmother, whatever it is. So there are a lot of things that we can do, and they work. I mean, that's the thing, is that they work. Instead of just telling our children, you know, to say, no, drugs are bad, they're going to hurt you, we have to understand the worlds that they're living in, and they're living in worlds that are really hard. I mean, I think it's always hard to have been a child, a teenager, but I think it's harder now. The pressures are great on our kids.
David Sheff is the author of the new book, Clean, Overcoming Addiction and Ending America's Greatest Tragedy. He's in town for two events. He will speak tonight at 6:30 at Highland Park High School. That event is open to the public. He's also got an appearance at the Dallas Country Club tomorrow at 11:30 to benefit CARE. David, it's been wonderful to have you on the program. Thank you so much.
Oh, Chris, thank you so much. Great conversation.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. Catch me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink. Again, I am Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.